Hello everybody and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola and I am full of energy because I ate 1,000 cookies over the past 48 hours. And there's some out there, everybody in the control room, so feel free to eat a few. But I'm very excited to be back because we do have an awesome show for you. Coming up in just a little bit, Jordan Yule, progressive activist, is gonna be joining us to break down some of the big news of the day, including a fascinating report from The Intercept about how some of Mike Bloomberg's campaign work is being done. Who is he tapping to do this work? Fascinating information there. A little bit later on, we have a congressional candidate who's gonna be joining us. We're gonna be breaking down some recent changes to the way pork manufacturers are gonna be regulated or not regulated, more importantly. And then at the end of the show, we're gonna have a little conversation about something that I think is on a lot of people's minds as we proceed through this Democratic primary. And that is, what will happen if X candidate gets the nomination? Will their other candidate supporters support that candidate and vice versa? Who can we trust? Well, there's a narrative out there and I've looked at some survey data and does not support what a lot of people think might happen. So I'm gonna be breaking that down. But before that, we're gonna start off with a little bit of news coming out of the holidays. So let's go over here. It was just Christmas, and what did we get for Christmas from the most powerful person in our country, Donald Trump? Well, you got two things at least. One was this website. So let's take a look at a screenshot from snowflakevictory.com. This was spread by Trump's campaign, and it's how to win an argument with your liberal relatives, because going into the holidays, that's what you should be thinking about. You know, like Jesus would. So first of all, I'll give an idea of the sorts of suggestions they have. Let's leave that up for 1 second because there's two things there you need to see. So one, they provide evidence to present in arguments. The first is the Trump economy is strong. And I thought, well, that's a good point. I don't know how to respond to that. But anyway, the second thing is I just want to briefly mention this because our producer Sophie brought this up. The website is literally snowflakevictory.com. And I get what they're going for. What they're going for is a victory over snowflakes, but that's not how you'd put it for anything else. If you were like back in the early 40s preparing to storm Berlin, it wouldn't be like strategies at germanvictory.com. Why is it snowflake victory? Anyway, small point, but to give an idea of the other sort of advice they're arming MAGA heads for before they sit down for like quiche and goose or whatever, let's take a look at some of their suggestions. So there was no quid pro quo. Democrats always obsessed with impeachment. That's gonna sway your aunt who doesn't like Trump. Joe Biden threatened to withhold $1 billion in aid from Ukraine unless they fired the prosecutor looking to the company where his son worked. That has not been debunked. So if you have to put that has not been debunked, when by the way, important note, it 100% has been debunked, that's funny. Their next point is just in all caps, the words big government socialism. I don't know what you're supposed to do with that. And then Trump is proving it's possible to have a strong economy and a clean environment at the same time. Here's the thing, that claim is true except for the Trump part. It is 100% possible to have a strong economy and a clean environment. He's just not interested honestly in either part of that, really. He's interested in investors getting a payoff. He's not interested in the strength of the economy when it comes to the actual people contributing to it. And he certainly doesn't care about the environment. Google Trump clean air, Trump clean water, Trump waters of the Americas, Trump coal plants. Google anything you want basically and it's gonna prove how inaccurate that is. But unfortunately, I wasn't at these dinner tables. So I guess they just had snowflakevictory.com to educate people with. So that's one thing Trump gave you for Christmas this year. The other present under your tree was no food stamps, unfortunately, and other cuts to programs, anti-poverty programs, programs to make sure that people have food, especially in the holidays. We're talking about some of the poorest people in America, that they have aid for heating their homes, feeding their kids, those sorts of things. And look, we've talked about that a lot on the program. But thankfully for the holidays, two very notable politicians wrote a piece in The Guardian. This is Bernie Sanders and Rashida Tlaib. And Bernie tweeted out a link to this saying, as the new year approaches, let us commit to fighting for a government and an economy that works for the overwhelming majority of the people. That is how we will make food security a human right in America. Okay, so on the one hand, you have Trump. He's giving you ways to start a fight with your relatives and the holidays. By the way, like I grew up and I was lucky. I didn't see a bunch of fights at Thanksgiving or at Christmas, but I hear on TV and movies that it's very common. You don't need to help people produce that. It's just a thing that sort of comes. So he gives you fights at the dinner table. Bernie's trying to give you food if you can't afford it. And I want to delve into a little bit of what Bernie and Rashida Tlaib wrote in this piece, because I think it's important. And especially in the holidays, I don't want these sorts of stories to fall by the wayside. I don't want people to look back on the Trump years and just remember the highest profile scandals, Russia, Ukraine, things like that. I want you to remember the damage that was done, usually in the dark, to regular people, people who don't have a lot of advocates in the media. And so we do have some light being shed on that, with Bernie saying, and Rashida, just in time for the holidays, Trump has finalized the first of three policies that will make this disparity between the rich and the poor even more obscene. 2 years after passing a $1.5 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest Americans and large corporations, the Trump administration plans to strip 3.7 million people of their nutrition benefits. And the two go on to break down some of the different ways that this is being accomplished. The administration's first step is to kick 700,000 adults off of nutrition assistance as they struggle to find work. The second step, trying to punish families who have high childcare and housing costs. And third, they want to hurt families who already are making difficult choices between food and heat. And so there they're summarizing a number of different benefits cuts generally targeted at the extremely poor. And historically, if you are new to American politics, the American government has not been overly generous with benefits to people who most need it. Cutting it now is insult to injury. And he sums up some examples from different states around the country. Vermont could see a 30% cut to benefits, and 1 in 5 low-income people who rely on nutrition assistance could no longer be eligible to participate. In Michigan, about 1 in 7 would be kicked off food aid. And so in those two states, I mean, you are seeing measurable percentages of the entire needy population being cut off their benefits in one fell swoop in the holiday season from the Trump administration. And the argument that they would make, that conservatives make, is that if we want these people to become self-sufficient, we need to make them want it and need it. And nobody needs to work more than someone who literally can't eat unless they're working. But if you talk to the people who are actually working with these communities, they say that it is not so simple. These people aren't just lazing about eating their government cheese. They're looking for work. Some of them are not healthy enough to actually work. Some, because you've made it impossible for them to actually own their own car, can't afford to get to jobs that might otherwise want to hire them. It's a complex situation. And simply cutting the benefits is not necessarily the best way to help these people. But if you are trying to square the books a little bit after passing trillions in tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations, it certainly makes sense for that goal, okay? Now, they close by saying we can start to fix the situation by increasing nutrition assistance by $47 per person per month. That is the shortfall between what low-income people need to prepare adequate meals and what they get in benefits. We should also significantly increase the income threshold for this program so everyone who needs help gets it. We must also guarantee that all school children get free breakfast and lunch at every public school in America. And those sorts of things, which are very rarely even said, and obviously you don't expect anything like that to happen under Donald Trump. That is not just obviously reasonable, but incredibly cost efficient for the benefit that you get. It would cost very little, a tiny little fraction of the tax cuts that were passed a couple of years ago. And think about the good that it would do. And so I'll leave you with those two things. Think about who is best exemplifying the holiday spirit. Is it Donald Trump, a person who has the power to accomplish virtually anything he wants? He could pass something like this in a day if he actually wanted to. Or is it politicians like Bernie Sanders and Rashida Tlaib who are using their time in the holidays to advocate for people who desperately need help? I will leave that up to you. Now we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jordan Yule is going to be joining us to break down some of the news of the day after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So we've talked in recent weeks about the insane amount of money that two candidates are spending in this Democratic primary, Tom Steyer, and to a much greater extent recently, Mike Bloomberg is just spending tons together. I believe it is over $200 million so far in this cycle, which is crazy. And you might have gotten some phone calls from a campaign worker for Mike Bloomberg. And you might think, well, he's got a lot of volunteers considering he just entered this race. That might not actually be what it is. There was a really interesting report by John Washington, The Intercept. And here is what he found. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg used prison labor to make campaign calls. Through a third party vendor, the Mike Bloomberg 2020 campaign contracted New Jersey based call center Procom, which runs call centers in New Jersey and Oklahoma. Two of the call centers in Oklahoma are operated out of state prisons. In at least one of the two prisons, incarcerated people were contracted to make calls on behalf of the campaign. The people were required to end their calls by disclosing that the calls were paid for by the campaign, but they did not disclose that they were calling from behind bars. So none of this, by the way, is illegal, but it is interesting when you have to sort of manufacture a popular base of support, it works in mysterious ways. And joining us now to break down this and other news, progressive activist Jordan Ewell, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So Bloomberg's campaign strategy kind of took an interesting turn there.
Yeah, so this reflects first like just billionaires and rich people in general, their callous disregard for incarcerated people. They're seen as subhuman. They're seen as not worthy of being paid the same as you or I for equal work. Their labor is exploited. This happens with multinational corporations and huge companies all over. Like, this isn't just a campaign thing, although that is why we're talking about it. But like, we need to, as we talk about this, we need to understand this happens all the time and their labor is always exploited and we need to be mindful of that. We should push back against that. So, but on Bloomberg itself, it shows that his campaign has zero altruistic or, you know, authentic momentum. He's astroturfing his campaign, and as a result, he's using and exploiting prison labor. I don't believe that they just didn't know. I think it's just that they got caught, and they should have been more careful, and they should have been more deliberative in how they vetted their clients or their subcontractors.
So Bloomberg has put out a statement about this, and we're gonna turn to that in 1 second. But I want to stay on the point that you were making there, because I remember something that happened earlier this year, and I found an issue that when you speak out in support of it, unites people across the spectrum against you, and that is, I think that people are being too hard on prisoners, or prisoners should get this right or privilege. People don't like that. And it was early this year that Bernie Sanders said that he believes that people who are in prison should be allowed to vote, not just when they leave prison, but while they're in prison. And lots of people hate that position. But you bring up a good point. I mean, they are exploited. And the issue with this is not that people in prison are working. If they want to use some of their time to make money, they should be able to. But that they're generally paid virtually nothing. They have no real rights or say or anything like that. I mean, that's the real issue. And especially when it's being used to sort of prop up the campaign of a guy whose positions on criminal justice in particular have been questionable at best over the past couple of decades. It just seems, I think, to really put a spotlight on an issue that very rarely is talked about.
Totally. I mean, Bloomberg was the stop and frisk guy.
Exactly.
Broken windows policing and tactics like stop and frisk have put a ton of people in prison or jail and left people with criminal records that will haunt them forever. This guy is very aggressive on criminal justice and criminal policy and now is exploiting their labor for personal gain. This is not someone that we should welcome into the fray in the Democratic Party as the party shifts left and as we have a progressive wave, just sweeping the nation. This is a guy who's seeking to undermine all that effort on a self-aggrandizing and self-funded campaign that ultimately serves to protect his and other billionaires and billionaires' wealth.
And man, when I think about, oh God, the money, how that could have been spent. But like I said, he did put out a statement. So here's Mike Bloomberg saying, earlier today, a news outlet reported that prison workers were being used by a subcontractor to make telephone calls on behalf of my campaign. I'm not attacking the news. The story was fundamentally accurate. We only learned about this when the reporter called us. But as soon as we discovered which vendor's subcontractor had done this, we immediately ended our relationship with the company and the people who hired them. Jordan, what do you think about that explanation?
Well, I mean, it's just he's just trying to save face. It was a quick, fleeting apology, and they're hoping everyone moves on. But nowhere in that was it, hey, these people should be treated better. Hey, these people should make more than $20 an hour. Yeah. $20 a month. He wasn't saying like, hey, he doesn't feel sympathy for the people. He's just saying, we got caught, we're sorry, we're moving on. It would have been a welcome apology if it was like, hey, and I'm actually going to go a step further, and I'm going to advocate for people in prison whose labor is being exploited to help them develop new skills and also reenter society, because recidivism is a huge problem, and he's doing nothing for that.
Yeah, in a different primary, it would be a great opportunity for someone to bring up these issues on the debate stage and question him about that. But of course, he's not going to be on the debate stage because he's not really seriously pursuing the nomination. He doesn't care about actually qualifying. Okay, let's turn to one other big story in the news this morning. This morning, I saw a really interesting piece that I wasn't expecting, although in retrospect, I guess it was inevitable. This Politico piece, Democratic Insiders, Bernie could win the nomination. It only took them like 12 months to realize he could win the nomination. And so what this article is talking to a number of different Democratic insiders about their dawning realization that Bernie Sanders has supporters and he is poised to do extremely well in the early primary contests with a longtime Hillary Clinton ally David Brock saying, it may have been inevitable that eventually you would have two candidates representing each side of the ideological divide in the party. A lot of smart people I've talked to lately think there's a very good chance those two end up being Biden and Sanders. They've both proven to be very resilient. Well, yes, very smart. Took him a year and the 2016 election to realize that Sanders is a strong candidate in this primary. So we have more on this, but Jordan, what do you think about this? Like, we're less than like, I think a month out from Iowa now, and just now some of these people are acknowledging that Bernie Sanders is not just technically in this thing.
Right, they can't deny it any longer. I mean, the Sanders campaign staying power is a force to be reckoned with. He has consistently been polling at or near the top for months. He hasn't had these surges and then just quick plummets like we've seen with other candidates. He's got the grassroots organizing support. He's got the fundraising. He's got the likability, and now he has the electability. They can't deny this any longer. He consistently polls above just about everybody else in head-to-head polls against Trump. And now he's leading in second in just about every early voting state. Sanders is clearly a uniting force and a uniting candidate. He can pull people from all sides of the aisle, and he taps into this anti-Washington sentiment that Trump did. And granted, Trump did this fraudulently, but there is this growing animosity towards the political elite and the political establishment in Washington. People are no longer, are no longer just buying into this belief that Washington collectively works for them. More and more people are recognizing that the whole system is a scam, and Sanders taps into that sentiment and that resentment. He will do this altruistically because he's been fighting for working people his entire life, his entire professional career, and voters recognize that. Yeah. So they can't deny it any longer. That's the main point.
Yeah, and the thing is like, what's so ironic is that people, honestly, like me and you, who've been saying this for a long time that you should take him seriously, we're stupid idiots. Off on the fringes, but very smart, serious people are just starting to realize that he has, the highest favorability numbers of any of the candidates inside of the Democratic Party, that like virtually everyone has donated to his campaign at this point. As you point out, he's polling first, I think, in New Hampshire, second in Iowa. He's doing very well in Nevada as well. Like, these are important things, and that does not mean that he's going to win necessarily. We should also point out that Biden in national polls is still up by a good number of points. We have to be able to acknowledge those, but it's just very odd that it took him this long. I want to give a couple of the arguments that are made in this argument about why they're starting to realize it. First, Elizabeth Warren has recently fallen in national and early state surveys. I would add to that that Buttigieg appears to have plateaued and is now going down a little bit too. Second, Sanders has withstood the ups and downs of the primary, including a heart attack that you would imagine for any other candidate above 70 years old would probably have ended this thing. And at the same time, people like Harris and Booker and O'Rourke, who were considered to potentially have explosive potential by people like David Brock, have dropped out or are stuck in the low single digits. And so what do you think about some of those arguments? Like the expectation that theoretically someone at a debate could take down Sanders with a strong attack and that hasn't materialized. They sort of go on to point out that Bernie hasn't really been attacked that much by the other candidates so far.
Well, that's also because a lot of the opposition research and a lot of the attacks have already been aired out in 2016. That he still has this momentum now shows that they really weren't fatal attacks, and there's no real fatal flaws to Sanders as a candidate or the Sanders platform or the campaign. And the heart attack thing just shows that despite that, what you say would probably end many other candidates' prospects, this didn't really have much of an impact. If anything, we saw a new boost of energy. That shows that people really buy into this worldview and this progressive platform, this whole plan that he's putting forward, because people know that, look, if he gets in there and even if he is in worst case scenario, isn't healthy, the ideas that he's putting forward and the people he'll put in place to enact those ideas will, is more than just him. It'll transcend him as a person. It'll last like a generation. But one thing I do want to point out is the one group and person in that article who refuses to acknowledge Sanders and his viability is the guy who started Third Way. Third Way is one of the most ghoulish, vile organizations in DC. It basically takes money from corporations and special interests and turns around and says to the general public, hey, we've done a bunch of research, and actually, Democratic voters want exactly what these corporations and special interests want. They're seeking to undermine progressive momentum in this country. They're trying to undermine Medicare for all. They want money in politics. And at the end of the day, if Sanders wins, it upends their whole scheme and shows they've been on the wrong side of history on so many progressive issues throughout their entire organization's existence.
So I have one more question for you, because I don't know if this article and the fact that there's this talk going around might be a sign of this, but my suspicion, and I think a lot of people are starting to suspect this, is that so far the media in general has not talked much about Bernie Sanders. Not much favorable, honestly, not even that much critical. They've mostly avoided talking about him. And you can look at analyses of number of mentions of candidates versus their polling. And some candidates are getting talked about more than their polling merits, some less so. Bernie Sanders is the biggest gap. Even Joe Biden, by the way, considering how his polling is, talked about a little bit less than you might expect. But my expectation is that as we get closer to Iowa, and especially if he does take Iowa, New Hampshire, that the Bernie blackout will turn into the Bernie like frontal assault in the media. Is that something that you expect might happen?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this we've that the Bernie blackout exists because his candidacy and his Sanders presidency would affect their bottom line. So if it gets even closer to him winning the nomination, they will all, you know, just all out assault on Bernie Sanders as the candidate and the nominee, because they really need to protect their cash flow and their money going forward. This is the problem with corporate media in general. They have a vested interest in attacking progressive candidates and keeping them at bay, outright ignoring them. And it's going to get uglier the closer he gets to winning the nomination. That's, I think, you're spot on there.
And I would say, look, as long as they're attacking him on the policies and not spreading misinformation about policies like the Green New Deal or Medicare for All, I am totally down for that. I would say, look, I personally think that those policies are incredibly popular. I think that spending more time talking about them on CNN and MSNBC would be good for the primary. I just suspect that that's probably not the form that these attacks will take.
No, not at all. And that's just not how they fundamentally do political coverage and analysis. They'll have people on who probably like worked for the Hillary campaign or paid by the DNC as consultants go on and attack him on like these purely subjective categories like likability and electability and all these weird things. They'll say, oh, you know, he isn't the guy. He can't win over XYZ type of voter when, you know, he probably could. They will just they'll run interference with people who already don't like him through the guise of analysis. They won't talk about policy, although it would be nice if we actually did have meaningful policy discussions on national news. But that, John, that is a pipe dream.
Probably. And anyone, perhaps a booker or producer for one of these shows on CNN and MSNBC, feel free to have Jordan or I on. If you wanna talk about policy and break down the specifics, we can do that. I expect that I'll be sticking around here, and hopefully Jordan, you'll join us in the near future.
At any time you want, John.
Thank you. And thanks for joining us today. We'll see you soon. And we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. When you hear the term government regulations, what do you think of? I have an idea. I think for a lot of you, you probably instinctively think, oh, that's something that's holding business back. It's like handcuffs on business from making money, getting the economy booming and all that. And the reason that I think a not small number of you think that is because for literally decades, businesses have been paying politicians and media figures to put that out there, to create that narrative. But it's just not true. Government regulations are protections for you. That's all they are. They're one of the only times the government does something that a business doesn't like to protect you or your family or the environment. And I've got a perfect example of what that looks like right here. A story from last week that unfortunately a lot of people are ignoring that has to do with the safety of your food. What actually makes it into your food? So let's take a look at how the Trump administration wants to change regulations on pork manufacturers. And it has to do with the people who are looking at what's in that pork. So in traditional plants, as many as 7 federal inspectors work on a processing line, handling hog carcasses and checking for defects. And we're gonna get very specific about those defects in a bit. Under the new system, that number will be reduced to just 2 or 3 federal inspectors who will have more experience, but who will have limited hands-on interaction with the carcasses. So right off the bat, you have less than half the number of inspectors, and they're explicitly going to be spending less time actually looking at and touching the hog carcasses. Instead, in this new system, the plant's own employees will be checking and sorting the hog carcasses and letting the federal inspectors, called consumer safety inspectors, check their work from a distance. There is no required federal training for those employees. Now, I wanna talk to you very seriously and very honestly here. Let's be reasonable. If you were a massive pork manufacturing plant, and understand that something like 90% of all of the pork eaten in America is produced by just a couple of different corporations, what do you think about the old system versus the new system? Okay, it's gonna be pitched to you, this new system, as being more efficient and better. But if you were one of those corporations, which would you prefer? 7 inspectors getting into the line and looking at things and touching things? Or 2 or 3 people off over there and you have your own employees checking the line? And there's no regulations on how you have to train those people. Which sounds better for the manufacturer? And which sounds better for the person who wants to eat some sausage at the end of the day? Under which system do you think the meat is gonna have less stuff in it that you don't actually want? I think the answer is pretty clear. And understand that they're also gonna be changing how fast this whole process works. So removal of federal speed limits to inspect hog meat is also part of the new rules. Currently, the speed limit is set at processing 1,106 hog carcasses per hour. That's the old limit. The new limit is gonna be faster. And I don't know about you, the way I grew up, I immediately think of I Love Lucy, except instead of jamming meat, like a chocolate in their mouth, they're jamming hog hoofs. I don't know, but it's a lot. And it's amazing that they're able to do their job under the current speed limits. Imagine now less than half the people off in the back of the room having a smoke as the thing is going by even faster than before. And so, what are the actual stakes here? What could get into that meat that you might not want? Well, it's pretty bad. Potential defects include feces, hopefully pig, I imagine, sex organs, toenails, bladders, and unwanted hair. And as Brett Ehrlich pointed out, what hair do you want in your pork? I don't know, they don't get into details there. So here's the thing. There are currently regulations that I would argue have always been very lenient. I mean, you saw the old speed limit. You saw what they were getting away with at these pork manufacturing plants. Back in the day, there used to be videos of how they'd treat the hogs at these plants, and they were devastating. So devastating that in a number of states, they made it illegal to film what is going on there. That was the old system. This new system, which they guarantee you is gonna be better for business, but also better for the consumer, takes the inspectors off the line, cuts them in half, and makes the corporations responsible for training their own employees with no regulations on what that training actually has to entail. And so this is just one set of regulation changes, and you can see how slanted toward corporations it is. And I mean, I want you to care more about what's in your pork and what's in your food, but more importantly, I want you to be ready the next time you see a news report where a politician is saying that overregulation is what's wrong with the American economy, and that's what we need to fight. Just remember, regulations are protections. They're protections for you. Minor infringements on the profit-seeking abilities of these corporations to make sure that you're not eating pig poop when you have your breakfast sausage. It's simple as that. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, a congressional candidate's gonna be joining us after this. So far this year on the Damage Report, we have interviewed a lot of candidates for Congress, but I don't think so far we have ever once been able to talk to someone who is running to represent part of LA where we're shooting this show. Well, that changes today. We are now very happy to welcome to the show Frances Yasmin Motiwala. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you here. You're running for California's 34th district, and right off the bat, when I was doing some looking into you and your record, your policies you're pushing for, I saw when I Googled you, the first thing that comes up is you're working to eliminate nuclear weapons and homelessness, neither of which are two of the topics that normally first come up when you're looking for a congressional candidate. So talk to me a little bit about that.
All right. So I spent the last 11 years as a grassroots organizer with a nonprofit, Peace Action, the nation's oldest, largest grassroots advocacy organization for peace and nuclear disarmament. During my time, I've learned a lot about the risks that we face with nuclear weapons, the costs to our society. And actually during my time as an organizer, I spoke to thousands and thousands of people doing face-to-face organizing. And one thing I learned is that all across the political spectrum, everyone wants to get rid of nuclear weapons. If it's just whether or not people think that have the capacity to believe that it's possible. Mm-hmm. And I believe that nuclear weapons are making us less safe rather than more safe. And I think that we need to, America should be leading the rest of the world, but instead we are trailing behind. 122 countries have signed a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, which is a great step. And I think that we have to, at a time when, especially in my district, which is one of the poorest districts in the entire country. And let me say that again, downtown Los Angeles, most of Northeast LA, we are one of the poorest in the entire country. Our average median income in my district is about $30,000. And there's parts of the district that have half of that, $15,000 a year people are living off of. Yeah. Or just surviving. So when you do the math and you've got companies who are, you know, maintaining nuclear weapons, building them, and this constant investment of more and more money into these outdated weapons. And then you look at the poverty and the inequity in our and things that we need. The fact that politicians always say or don't seem to wonder where money will come for these wars and nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, when it comes to education and paying our teachers living wages and creating the infrastructure we need, suddenly it's everyone scrambling to find the money. So I believe that we need to internationally really invest more in real diplomacy, in development, and not just in our Defense Department. And then back here at home, I think that we need to be thinking about what domestic diplomacy actually looks like. Right now, we have a you know, we're living with our police are trying to solve all the problems. And we need to, I think, really look at what community building looks like. What does infrastructure investment look like? How do we create, diplomacy here at home and abroad? And so that's where I came from,
Okay, look, I'm glad that you're bringing up a number of these different issues, but especially like rethinking our international diplomacy. Most congressional candidates don't talk much about foreign policy. So you've mentioned wanting to move towards the elimination of nuclear arsenals. What are some of your other foreign policy goals? If you get into Congress and you're pushing the president in these areas, what would you like to see done in terms of foreign policy?
So one of the things I spent many years working on was passing the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. And I think that, you know, this administration has taken us the opposite direction. And I think members of Congress need to be incredibly vocal and doing everything they can to get us back on a path of communication, of good communication with Iran. We need to, you know, I think also looking at who we are allied with in across the world. We need to be pushing even our friends to live up to human rights values that we should be promoting. And I think we got to get past a kind of a reliance and just being the policing the world. But we really have to figure out how we work multilaterally with other countries. Diplomacy with Iran, I mean, immediately we need to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. We need to increase arms control regulations, and we need to work with other nations on what real peace could look like. And I think that's, I mean, there's so many things. hard to say where to start, but I think immediately it's, restoring the diplomatic path with Iran is I think, number one.
Okay.
And
Okay. And so returning to you were talking about the fact that you would be representing the poorest districts in the entire country. In terms of policies that could help to either uplift the extremely poor, reduce income inequality, what are some of the proposals domestically that you'd like to see put into effect?
Yeah, well, and especially because my district is at the forefront of the housing crisis. We have 1/6 of Los Angeles's population, but 1/3 of the population experiencing homelessness. And there's many some things that we can change that will make at the national level that will make a direct impact. One is a housing guarantee, and I believe in a massive investment in public housing. I believe that we need to pass Medicare for All, including a strong mental health and dental health component. I believe that we need to, reform our criminal justice system and move to a restorative justice approach where, you know, people get out of jail and have a really hard time finding housing and jobs. And we need to reshape that. We need to be supporting our vets as they come out of wars. And we need to obviously do a better job of rehumanizing them and providing support. 25% of our population experiencing homelessness served in wars. And also a major population is queer youth, not even just youth, but queer people, especially queer people of color who aren't finding the support from their families or community. We need to invest there. And all of these pieces will help eliminate parts of the population experience of homelessness, get them rehoused, and we'll be a better society for it.
Okay, and Frances, where can people find out more about your candidacy?
FYM2020.com is my website, FYM2020.com. On social media, you can find me at FYM for Congress, spelled out F-O-R, Congress.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Frances Yasmin Motiwala, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, a little narrative going around about the Democratic primary, where it could go from here. I found some data that sort of undercuts it, so we're gonna break that down after this. Okay, as we get closer and closer to the first primaries and caucuses, I know there's a lot of worries out there about what could end up happening in this Democratic primary contest. And one of the worries that I know is out there that I've heard people whisper about is, oh, this Bernie Sanders guy, these Bernie Sanders supporters, if it's not Bernie, they're probably just gonna vote for Trump. They're gonna turn their backs and let Trump get reelected. And I get that there's a lot of people who despise Bernie Sanders, despise his supporters, that believe that that's true, or at least want to say it because it makes them sound bad. But it's not true. And I have actually 5 reasons you shouldn't believe that. Stick around for the 5th because it will shock you. It's actually polling data. But I wanna run through 4 other ones first of all. So if that's your fear, that if Bernie Sanders was not the nominee, he's not gonna support the person who is. Well, first of all, remember in 2016 when he supported the one who was not Bernie Sanders. He did that. He did dozens of events around the country, told his supporters to support Hillary Clinton. So all of the evidence shows that he will continue to do that. And by the way, as number 2, a direct comparison to 2008, we can look at the survey data for Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016 versus Hillary Clinton supporters in 2018, where a higher percentage supported the Democratic candidate in 2016 than in 2008. They have shown themselves historically, Bernie Sanders supporters, to be more reliable in supporting the Democratic candidate. So that is number 2. Number 3, even in comparison to 2016, do you really think there's a lot of people in this country that want a second Donald Trump term? I know there's a few people who are doing fine the way things are. They may not like some of the things he says, but they're doing just fine and they don't want to rock the boat. But I think that's a pretty small population. And so I think that we're moving in a direction where everyone agrees that Donald Trump getting out would be a good thing. Number 4, in terms of these people that hypothetically you think that these Bernie Sanders supporters are gonna vote for, a lot of them probably aren't gonna run. And I know it's very common, there's articles every day. There was an article today, Tulsi Gabbard is gonna run as a third party candidate. And I've already done videos on this, so I'm not gonna run through the whole thing, but she's not gonna run as a third party candidate. She said many, many, many times she's gonna support the eventual Democratic nominee, that running as a third party candidate would only make it more likely that Trump gets elected. She said this over and over and over and over again. So one less reason to worry. But the 5th is the actual data out there, because the argument, the belief is that Bernie Sanders supporters are unreliable, that if they don't get their guy, they're gonna just bolt. And that's just not what the actual survey data we have shows. So let's go into it. So for the control room, let's ignore this first graphic. We're not gonna go to that. Let me jump into a comparison. If the general election are these matchups, how would supporters of other candidates turn out? So first of all, let's imagine if it is Bernie Sanders, if it's Donald Trump versus Bernie Sanders where would Biden supporters go? Well, 7%, it turns out, would support Donald Trump. 7% of Elizabeth Warren supporters would support Donald Trump. 15% of Buttigieg's supporters would support Donald Trump. So those numbers are not overwhelming, they're small no matter what, but bear them in mind as we go into other potential matchups. So what if it's Donald Trump versus Joe Biden? That seems kind of likely, he's winning in all the polls so far. 5% of Sanders supporters would support Donald Trump. 11% of Warren's supporters would support Donald Trump, and 9% of Buttigieg's. So if it's not Bernie, the current leader right now, you can expect that Bernie's supporters will be basically, under certain definitions, twice as reliable as Warren and Buttigieg's supporters. If it's neither of those two, let's go to number 3, that's Elizabeth Warren, it could still happen. Donald Trump versus Elizabeth Warren. Biden supporters, 10% would flip to supporting the Republican. Sanders, 4%. Buttigieg's, 12%, even beating the Biden supporters. So again, the Sanders supporters under this metric are at least twice as loyal as the supporters of Joe Biden and Buttigieg. And what if it's Buttigieg? I mean, he's in 4th, he's sort of going down in the polls a little bit. But you see here that if that was the case, 12% of Biden's supporters would flip, just 4% of Sanders, and 11% of Elizabeth Warren. So in all of these cases, and I understand it could still hypothetically be someone else, Andrew Yang is coming in strong at number 5th and all that, but it's probably gonna be one of these 4. And if it is, if it's not Bernie Sanders, his supporters will be more loyal to the eventual candidate than in any other alternate future that we can expect. Now, I don't expect that this one poll is gonna convince people. They're gonna look into this in more stuff. This is just Emerson. We'll look at other things too. But in terms of actual empirical data, raw facts, the idea that people could be spreading this concept that Bernie Sanders supporters are just itching for an opportunity to bolt and get Donald Trump reelected in 2020, everything in our past says that that's not true. Everything that we're seeing now says that that's not true. It is a BS narrative, and it's on us to fight back against it. Because it is, at the end of the day, really just an attempt to slander Bernie Sanders supporters and the man himself by proxy. Okay, thank you to everyone who joined me on this show, the first show back from the holidays. Also, for those of you who have been rating and reviewing the podcast, really fast, Sotwell says, Brooke is my favorite co-host for the Damage Report. You guys are fire together, and I really appreciate that. Everyone who rates and reviews the podcast, it's a big help for us. We do appreciate it. Lots more planned for Friday. Brett will join us. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.